Welcome to Observations, podcast from Medical Observer. My name is Annette Catalaris. The National Cervical Screening Program has been extremely successful. Since its inception in 1991, deaths from cervical cancer have fallen from 4 to 1.8 per 100,000 women, making cancer of the cervix a relatively rare disease in Australia. There have been many developments in the last few decades that have influenced screening programs worldwide. With this in mind, the Department of Health and Ageing, in wide consultation with cervical screening experts, is reviewing our screening program. I am delighted to welcome Associate Professor Dorota Gertig to discuss the issues that this review will consider. We'll be speaking by phone, so apologies for the sound quality. Associate Professor Gertig is a public health physician and is the Medical Director of the Victorian Cervical Cytology Registry and Principal Research Fellow at the University of Melbourne. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Annette. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
The Medical Services Advisory Committee is considering recommending increasing the screening interval for women from 2 to 3 years from age 25 to 49, then to 5 years from age 50 to 65. What's the rationale behind this change?
Well, Annette, as you mentioned, our cervical screening program has been very stable over the last 20 years. And over the last 10 years or so, we've learnt a lot about the natural history and the biology of HPV infection. And in addition, we've also had a very intensive screening program compared to other countries internationally. The International Agency for Research on Cancer recommends a starting age of 25, a 3-year interval up to age 50, and 5 yearly after that, as you mentioned. So the change could potentially bring us in line with other countries.
It's something that isn't discussed very often are the risks of screening. You know, for example, we know that women who had 2 yearly screening underwent 40% more colposcopies than those screened every 3 years. And we know that unnecessary treatment of pre-invasive lesions can cause long-term problems such as cervical stenosis and preterm delivery. Given that a longer screening interval has been widely adopted elsewhere, particularly in the UK, without any apparent adverse effects, have we been slow on the uptake?
No, I don't think so. I think we've had an excellent screening program and that has shown a substantial decline in incidence and mortality. So when something's working really well, it is hard to make those changes. But I think the evidence now around the new technologies, around what's happening internationally, is becoming overwhelming, really, and it's important for a refresh of the program.
One of the other changes being considered is delaying the starting age of screening to 25, regardless of age of first intercourse. What's the evidence for this?
Well, screening is always about balancing the risks and the benefits. And for younger women, because HPV infection is so common and there is such a long latency from infection with HPV to development of more serious lesions and in particular invasive cervical cancer, treatment of those early lesions in young women may result in more harm than benefit. And as you mentioned, certainly in the UK, they've adopted an age 25, that's the starting age at age 25, and which they also recently reviewed and they have stuck with that. And they're seeing similar outcomes to their cervical screening program as we have in Australia with a much more intensive screening program.
I'm sure a lot of older women will be pleased to know that one of the other options on the table is age of last smear at 65, provided they've had a good screening history and are not at major risk of invasive cervical cancer. Is that the same rationale? Tell us why that's a reasonable position.
I think the consideration there is the potential use of an HPV test as an exit test for women aged 65. And we'll discuss this again in a moment, I'm sure, but HPV testing has a very high negative predictive value. And so if it was used as an exit test, it would ensure that older women exiting the program could be assured that they are actually free of HPV infection, of persistent infection, and would have a substantially lower risk of developing cervical cancer. So that would give them additional protection while being able to cease screening at an earlier age. So obviously the evidence will need to be considered carefully, but that would be the potential scenario.
So that's regardless of whether or not they take on a new sexual partner?
I'm sure that situation will be considered as part of the evidence. And as I mentioned, there is a very long latency from HPV infection to development of invasive disease. But that might be a situation that will be, need to be considered as a special case.
So the HPV test that we have at present does, as you say, have a high negative predictive value, and it also has a quite high sensitivity. But it's currently only funded as a test of cure from high-grade intraepithelial disease of the cervix. Until now, MSAC has regarded it as a cost-effective option for this role only and not for routine screening. Do you expect this to change?
Well, it's certainly been considered as part of the renewal process. The last review by MSAC considered HPV testing as a triage test for low-grade abnormalities, and at that time it was considered not to be cost-effective, but at that point they didn't consider it as a primary screening test. I think the evidence now from overseas, from the trials that have been conducted, is really accumulating, and it could well prove to be a cost-effective option to use HPV as the primary screening test, followed by a number of triage options.
Right, and the other thing that the HPV testing does is allow you to extend the screening interval. Is that correct? So we're looking at a 5-year interval rather than a 3-year interval.
Absolutely. Because that negative predictive value is so high, it means that if the test is negative, you can be quite confident that you are truly negative, and that is clear of high-risk HPV infection, then that does allow for longer interval, potentially even 6 years.
I believe Australia was the first country in the world to roll out the HPV vaccine, and the data that you published in The Lancet shows that it's already having an impact on cervical abnormalities in young Victorian women. But given that the existing screening program alone was so effective, and that the benefits of additional vaccination are marginal, do you think the widespread rollout of the vaccine to include boys and older women is justified?
Well, again, I believe that this was all carefully considered in terms of a cost-effectiveness analysis and in terms of giving boys the benefit of protection against HPV-related cancers, in particular anogenital cancers and oropharyngeal cancers, so the direct benefits for boys, plus probably a more incremental benefit in terms of improved herd immunity for girls, then certainly it was justified.
The naysayers would say that there's a huge outlay for a very marginal benefit, you know, like the numbers needed to treat are massive.
Well, again, I guess that it was considered by the MSAC PDAC process, and presumably ended up being cost effective, with obviously one of the key inputs being the cost of the vaccine, which wasn't made public, but I guess the cost must have been fewer than the benefits.
And what about any potential harms from this mass vaccination campaign? Are there any that we know of that have been clearly documented?
Well, what we've learned since the introduction of the vaccine is three things. Firstly, that we've got a very high uptake, and it was well accepted and widely adopted by young Australian women. So the completion of the vaccine, three-dose coverage, was over 70%. We've also learned that it's very safe. So the adverse events have been relatively few. We've had more than 97 million doses worldwide, about 7 million in Australia, and the vast majority of adverse events have been mild, and as you would expect with any new vaccine, you know, local reactions, headaches, dizziness, etc. And severe adverse reactions have been very rare.
That's reassuring. Let's talk more about the pap smear itself. Can you enlighten us as to what we're up to with liquid-based cytology testing?
So liquid-based cytology has been available in Australia for some time. It hasn't been recommended for adoption into the cervical screening program because basically has been considered equivalent to pap tests in terms of its benefits, but hasn't made it in terms of the cost-effectiveness ratios. So it is used in Australia, but not funded as part of the cervical screening program. Interestingly, there's quite a wide variation across the country in terms of its prevalence of use. Quite frequently used in New South Wales, and very rarely in Victoria.
The last time that liquid-based cytology testing was reviewed by MSAC in 2011, they found that liquid-based cytology and the standard technologies were both safe and equally effective, but that liquid-based testing was not cost-effective, so that it is, to this day, is not funded. But there are plenty of women paying for the test. I guess what I want to know is it money well spent? Is it time the test was funded? And when is it indicated?
So I think it's arguable that it's money well spent if the benefits are similar to that of conventional cytology. It is used in some instances where women have unsatisfactory tests. However, it hasn't been recommended in the National Cervical Screening Program to this date. What I would say that, though, is as part of the renewal process and in terms of the primary HPV testing, that would use liquid-based cytology because it's much easier to do the HPV test on a liquid-based test than it is to do it on a Pap test. So almost the two really go hand in hand. So it's certainly part of the renewal process.
About 70% of all cervical cancers are associated with HPV types 16 and 18, and there is already an FDA-approved test for these serotypes. Is there a role for it in our screening program? And if yes, why isn't it funded?
So there has been a development of HPV tests over the last few years that do allow for partial genotyping. In other words, the results are separated by whether the test was positive for HPV 16 or 18 or other high-risk HPV types. They are now available in Australia, but as you mentioned earlier, HPV testing is only indicated in Australia for a test of cure. Now, one of the issues with HPV testing is how you then manage and triage a positive HPV test result. And one of those options is actually to use partial genotyping for HPV 16 and 18. And that will also be considered as part of the renewal process, as I understand it.
Right. The other big development is the use of novel biomarkers. Can you tell us about that? And is that the future of screening?
Well, I think it's probably early days for some of the new markers. I mean, really, again, we're talking about options for management of HPV-positive women. And aside from partial genotyping, of course, the first one we'd consider is cytology triage. But there are other options, for example, dual-stain cytology, looking at overexpression of molecular markers such as P16 and Ki67. And other markers such as E6C7 messenger RNA markers. So these are all potentially under development, but I guess the two leading candidates are cytology triage and partial genotyping for 16 and 18. There is a large trial commencing in Victoria called the COMPASS trial, which is actually looking at primary HPV screening. And one of the arms in that trial will use partial genotyping for HPV 16 and 18, and also dual-stain cytology. So it's something that's now certainly being evaluated in Australia.
That's very exciting. So it's years away rather than decades away.
I would say so. Certainly there are a number of studies considering new markers, and we really need to be on top of them here in Australia.
You've been a consultant advisor for WHO in the Asian and Western Pacific regions. Cervical cancer remains a significant problem in most developing countries. Do you think the effort should be put into vaccination or better screening in these areas?
Well, that's certainly been a substantial debate when I've participated in some of the cervical cancer workshops in recent years. I think the best option really is to look at a comprehensive cervical cancer prevention program that incorporates both vaccination and cervical screening for older women, because obviously if you only target young women with vaccination, then you're effectively writing off the older cohorts of women. So a combination of the two is important, but it's a real challenge in most countries in the Asia Pacific region because they actually don't have organised screening programs as we do in Australia. Australia and New Zealand are the only countries in the entire Asia Pacific region that have a proper organised screening program. So there are certainly lots of challenges, and again, HPV testing may be one solution. The development of cheap, rapid HPV tests is on on the horizon. They're currently being evaluated and certainly very promising. So hopefully we'll see marked reductions in incidence and mortality in our neighbouring regions.
With the availability of self-testing using tampons and the like, why has it been so challenging to get screening programs up in these areas?
Well, again, it's really not just the test. It's actually how the whole program is organised. So having, you know, a magic test is not going to be the only solution. You have to have everything in place, such as organised policies, sufficient resources, training. You have to have registers or systems for reminders and follow-up. Unless you have all of those components, then you're not going to see the dramatic reductions in incidence and mortality that we've had in Australia. So you really need high participation in the program, and that's really the only way you can get it. And I think that's what a lot of these countries are facing in terms of challenges, because it's actually getting that organisation in place. It's not just having, you know, a specific test. And obviously conventional cytology is difficult to introduce. It's very subjective and can be difficult for low resource settings to in terms of quality monitoring.
So in Australia, when can we hope to hear from the renewal group?
I believe that the first phase that's being currently undertaken by the MSAC process will actually release some findings this year for public consultation, so it may be quite soon, and it's certainly a very exciting time for cervical screening.
Which sounds like it's needed, because I believe for the first time since the program started, participation rates have fallen. Is that correct?
I guess overall they have been stabilising over the last probably decade or so. We had substantial gains in the 90s, but participation rates have stabilised, and in some cases, particularly among younger women, have declined a little. So certainly maintaining participation, whatever the program will look like after the renewal process, is still going to be fundamental, because we know that most women who develop cervical cancer have either been never screened or underscreened.
Are there any other changes that are being considered to the screening program?
Well, as part of the renewal process, they'll also be investigating options around national data collection systems that will support the recommendations that will be made. And this will potentially include the functions of the registries. So at the moment we have 8 registries around the country, and one of the considerations will be whether we should have a national pap test register. They'll also be looking at quality management, and finally around the feasibility and acceptability of the recommended renewed program for women.
Yes, I don't think a national register could come a day too soon. It's a problem that's plagued so many diseases and so many groups.
Well, certainly our registries operate very well in terms of the reminder and follow-up functions, but there are some issues around cross-border data collection, and if we do move to a longer screening interval, obviously it will be critical to follow up women and remind them for when they're due, and that might potentially involve a call recall system such as they have in the UK.
I think that could only be beneficial. Thanks very much for your time today.
It's a pleasure, Annette.
I've been speaking with Associate Professor Dorota Gertig from the Victorian Cervical Cytology Registry. Thanks for joining me. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you join me next time for Observations, podcast from Medical Observer.